Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
The New Statesman.
Hi, it's Anoush.
And Armando.
And we just wanted to let you know before you listen to this series that we actually recorded it during Liz Truss's short-lived premiership.
Yes, which actually means that if you hear this, it's very, very valuable, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a piece of history.
Because it's so rare something was made during that tenure.
Hello, I'm Anoush.
And I'm Armando.
In this episode of Westminster Reimagined, we'll be joined by Dominic Waters, social worker and campaigner against food insecurity, and Adrian Buller, director of research at the think tank Commonwealth. We ask how we can make the economy work for everyone. Now, Armando, the UK is a really unequal country. The income gap in the UK is the largest it's been in 10 years. So now we live in a world where food bank use has almost doubled since 2014. Yeah. Nearly a third of low-income families are unable to heat their home. Meanwhile, the richest 1% of households in the UK are worth around £3.6 million each. So that tells you that something's broken.
Something is broken, and as you're saying, it's getting worse. And it's an issue, I think, that's just driven the last year of politics has not been about, yes, there's been a war in Ukraine, yes, there's been the pandemic, but I think beneath it all is the current food crisis, the current energy crisis, the spending crisis, and an awareness, I think, now across all parties that there is a huge crisis of inequality that has to be dealt with. We've been recording these podcasts over a period of time. When we started out, we didn't know who the next prime minister was going to be. As we're recording this one, we're now in a case where the solution to inequality is trickle-down economics. And I think I'm not the only one who's just thought, you know, if someone says to you, I'm really hungry, you don't say, well, in about 3 or 4 years' time, if we go for growth, there'll be a period where there'll be a greater investment in infrastructure that will consequentially benefit. You say, would you like something to eat? And, you know, if politics is about anything, it's about how do we survive? How do we get through the day? And I think this is an issue that's frustrated, annoyed, angered everyone, perplexed everyone. But what these podcasts are about are talking to people who hopefully are able to provide us with where there are solutions.
Now, I'm pleased that we're joined by two very special guests. Joining us today is Dominic Waters, a newly qualified social worker and campaigner against food insecurity, drawing on his lived experience of poverty. He is a Food Foundation ambassador and author of Social Distance in Social Work, COVID Capsule 1, which seeks to understand the impact of the pandemic through the lenses of poverty, culture and class. In November 2021, he launched the Food is Care campaign, calling for urgent action from the government and local authorities to address food insecurity and poverty. He is currently working to raise awareness of the snobbery and contempt people experience through the narrative of the undeserving poor.
And Adrian Buller is the Director of Research at Commonwealth, a progressive London-based think tank focused on building a democratic economy. She's the author of The Value of a Whale, which examines the illusions of green capitalism, and co-author of Owning the Future, which is about power and property in an age of crisis. And Adrian and Dominic, thank you both for joining us.
Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Dominic, I want to start with you because you have sort of gone on a journey in recent months from just sort of trying to live and survive and get a job, training to be a social worker, and now you've got a job in that sector, raising awareness of how difficult it's been to even afford food for you and your daughter at times. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your experience and also why you've decided to try and bring it into the public sphere?
Yeah, it has been a bit of a journey. So I'm a single dad. I live in a council estate block in the Garden of England in Kent with my amazing daughter. And I've been on child benefit, universal credit, free school meals for my daughter and the vouchers during the holidays, thanks to the work of Marcus Rashford the Food Foundation. And also we've always had pay-as-you-go gas and electric meter, which comes with its own lack of access to fuel. Because the shop in my estate, so it only sells the lowest quality of food produce, and there's no facility to top up your gas and electric key. So that's why I note that it's both a food and a fuel desert in the Garden of England.
That draws on the point you, Anoush, was making right at the start, that, you know, we have so much wealth and resources, and yet somehow we're not able to draw on them.
Yeah.
Right on your doorstep.
And I think it also speaks to, like, barriers in the way of social mobility and also the impact it has on your well-being and, like, your ability to engage in society. Because when your electric's on emergency, you don't want the fridge to run out in the middle of the night. Then the freezer, all the food that you had for your child isn't going to be good probably by the morning. You can't have a shower. You can't boil your kettle. And especially when my daughter was younger and that happened, unfortunately, quite regularly, just to do with financial limitations. And it's fine saying, oh, well, you should have planned for it. But if you just literally don't have the money, then, like, no amount of planning is going to kind of...
And also, once you're in the cycle of thinking just day by day, you can't pause that to think, oh, I'll strategize the next year.
Yeah.
You know, you've just got the next 24 hours to negotiate, really.
For real? Yeah, definitely.
And it's these kind of considerations, I think, our politicians... Well, some of our politicians don't necessarily seem to understand. So you had Jake Berry, who is chair of the Conservative Party, recently saying, if your fuel costs are going up, then just get a higher paid job. You know, and then you also have some MPs suggesting...
Well, that's what I've done, but...
Yeah. There we go, a vindication.
I'm yet to be paid. So just to say, I'm yet to be paid. And one of the holes in universal credit that there's many, it's a dehumanising system, it's broken... And I could, and I will speak more about it, but one thing I just found out, so I just got a job, but I obviously haven't been paid, and I'm applying for the petrol travel to work help. And she said, yeah, well, you have to supply this. I didn't have an email that I could show her then and there. And you get 25p a mile. I don't think that's in line with the cost of petrol.
Yeah.
So I think that needs to be reviewed, because if supposedly these state mechanisms are meant to be promoting people climbing the ladder or whatever, so to speak, that's not achieving that. Like, they haven't even responded to my request. So,
when did you make that decision to go into social work to start the whole process of training?
It's quite a long story, but just in terms of social work, I didn't have the finances to do anything, and it was only when my daughter was older that I could start thinking about a career for me. Because before, like, I'd have to be at the primary school gates, so you couldn't really study, and, you know, and especially when you're living in poverty, it's not like you got an au pair or things like that. Those sort of safety nets that other people with different statuses enjoy. But yeah, social work, it was, I could get a bursary to study it. That was one of the reasons. But once I started, it has been the most, on so many levels, like even my own identity. I was always like silenced by snobbery. I wouldn't be able to have this conversation now, 3-4 years ago. I think people need to remember food insecurity wasn't a term that was discussed. It wasn't in the public sphere, maybe in the US and Canada, but 2-3 years ago, before Marcus Rashford, it wasn't discussed. And that goes along with fuel poverty. But yeah, so social work, it's helped me like learn the language of how to express the inequalities that I experience as a single dad in poverty.
Are you saying it's a sort of, it's like a kind of straitjacket? It's not just about not being able to afford certain things, but there's a psychological constraint put on you. You're made to feel less about yourself. And
100%.
Yeah.
And it's where the impact is so broad in terms of your ability to engage in society, sustain relationships, be confident in the world, and also your physical and mental just well-being. When I was working with children in care, actually, and this was just before COVID, my first placement was with children in care, and I saw how they had a lack of access to nutrition. And I would, as the social work student, I was often tasked with taking them to the local food bank. They relied on the food bank and like donations of like nearly past its sell-by date food from local businesses. And on a Thursday, we got a delivery from Greg's Bakery. And that was like the choice most wanted picks because you don't have to cook. You know, it was, it was like the wanted food. And then, but I noticed how the key workers were using that food, the Greg's Bakery bits, as like a behavior controlling mechanism. So if residents or young people in care, if they'd gone against the rules of the scheme that week, like they'd come back past 10 or they'd, I don't know, done something else, then they weren't allowed access to that Greg's Bakery produce. And then when I'd go home, I kind of like internalized how like I've faced the same lack of access to nutrition that the young people in care were experiencing. And I did a bit of research, and that's when I came across the concept of food insecurity and kind of why it so resonated with me and my daughter's situation. And I've gone on to kind of highlight that I would strongly suggest, and through my experiences, even in professional spaces, the contempt towards a voice of poverty, even in a forward thinking profession.
I mean, even in the last week, we're recording this, you know, it's sort of first couple of weeks in October, after the crash caused by Kwasi Kwarteng's mini budget, the next thing that was suggested was cuts to benefits or not, as if the problem behind the economy was the welfare budget. And it absolutely infuriates me. I mean, this has been going for like 10, 20, 30 years, this natural default from economists and politicians to go towards the welfare sector rather than, there's 10 times more business fraud than there is benefit fraud.
Yeah.
20 times even, I think. And yet you don't get politicians saying we must have to go after tax fraud and business fraud. There were billions written off in the loan scheme during COVID, you know, loans to businesses that were fraudulent, but which the Treasury or Inland Revenue have said we just can't get it back. And I just wonder if this is there just a huge blindness or lack of awareness of how this is a mismatch of priorities, really.
I can't even be as generous as to say I think it's a lack of awareness. I think it's a very willful and deliberate blindness, right? And it's baked into every part of our system, right? So the healthiest type of food tends to be more expensive. You know, you pay a penalty for having a prepay meter of energy. Your unit cost tends to be higher than if you have a tariff. And so we've just, in it, to every possible system that supports the basics of life, we've baked in this kind of hostility towards poverty and hostility towards the working class. And no one bats an eye at the fact that, you know, people working 40 hours a week still require benefits just to survive. Yeah. That is not this idea of people being like scroungers, which is despicable and absolutely untrue. That is fundamentally a problem with the system in which you live. If you can be working full-time, more than full-time, and still barely afford to live.
I'm really grateful for you both raising that. And it's something that I've tried to, with my writing and thinking, tried to look at. And it is this unfortunate element that I think we have in English, maybe I'm saying it wrong, British culture, but definitely English I speak to, of this contempt and undeserving way of thinking about people that are poor. And it's okay.
As if it's their fault.
Yeah, it's okay for them to be hungry because they're poor.
Yes.
You know, they're a single parent because they're poor. Mm. And it's something that needs to be discussed more. Mm. And I'm so grateful to be here to kind of even like approach these sort of topics because it's something that is so ingrained that it really does need combating on a lot of levels.
And are we being efficient with our resources? You've written that a lot of our energy, the national grid, for example, isn't actually ours.
No. The way that our energy system operates is fundamentally irrational, right? So the UK really sets a global standard for just irrational privatization of all the systems that kind of support our ability to live. And energy is like really the top of the pile for that. So, you know, every aspect of our energy system, from the way it's generated to how it's transmitted by the national grid — it's called the national grid, it's a publicly listed company with lots of international shareholders — to the suppliers, and kind of every element is privately owned, is in theory meant to be regulated, but broadly is adding huge markups and costs at every stage that has, you know, real impacts on people's lives. I mean, we've done a lot of research at Commonwealth on the energy system, and, you know, between 2011 and 2010, the big six suppliers paid out, you know, close to £23 billion in dividends to their shareholders, even as, you know, energy prices consistently rose. And the same goes for the national grid, or this element that a lot of people don't think about or know of, which is the sort of more local distribution networks. Mm-hmm. They effectively get to operate as regulated monopolies, but they have the highest profit margin of any sector of the UK economy, not just the highest margins within the energy system, but the entire UK economy. You know, we're talking profit margins north of 40%. Mm-hmm. And that's just charging people for ownership of an asset that used to be public. Mm-hmm. And so we've organized this entire system around profitability in a way that is clearly failing. As of September of this year, there are, I think, 11 million households reporting that they were behind on their bills, and 5 million reporting that they were skipping meals to pay for their energy bills. That is an indefensible system. We're not doing the basics in terms of just delivering the fundamentals of life to millions of people. I think we need to be asking very serious questions.
Yeah, Dominic, you were saying you live in the Garden of England, and yet the food that you have access to is like always the low quality.
Lowest quality. Yeah. And just on the fuel thing, so we were, and it's been spoken about quite widely, that people who are often the most disadvantaged and vulnerable families in society are on pay-as-you-go gas and electric. We were told by the government we'd get a voucher on or about the 1st of October to top up your gas and electric. Still hasn't arrived. And what are we, the 12th or mid-October?
And it's getting colder.
Yeah. And so the fact that these issues aren't more broadly spoken about, it kind of resonates with those points around an approach to poor people as being undeserving. Like, that's a categorical error and failure.
Hi, Anoush here. We've got a special offer for Westminster Reimagined listeners. You can subscribe to The New Statesman for just £1 a week for 12 weeks. Just go to newstatesman.com/podcast offer. And you can check out all our podcasts, including audio long reads and World Review, at newstatesman.com/podcasts. We'll be right back.
From The New Statesman comes a new podcast, Audio Long Reads, the best of our reported features and essays, read aloud. Featuring writing from our authors, including the historian Colin Kidd on Watergate's renewed relevance in a post-Trump era.
Today's obsessions about a deep state took their rise in the 70s amid this climate of anxiety.
Jeff Dyer's reflections on how to grow old in America.
He was propped up in bed, proudly sporting a badge. Private medicine makes me sick.
Maria Vilcek tells the story of how the hard men of Belarusian football took on Alexander Lukashenko.
Hundreds of ultras were roughed up and held in custody. One was later found dead in suspicious circumstances.
Ease into the weekend with our audio long reads, published every Saturday morning. Just search Audio Long Reads from The New Statesman wherever you get your podcasts.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Well, given we, you know, to use that terrible phrase, we are where we are, and we have the government we have. You know, if you were, if you had access to the government, what would you want to most persuade them about in terms of perception and priorities?
Trickle-down economics is a lie that never has worked and never will. I don't know. It seems a good place to start. You know, cutting corporation tax has statistically like no correlation with economic growth. There are huge studies of meta-analyses that basically show there's just no relationship between those things. And yet we're forging ahead as if that is inevitably going to be the case. The same goes for cutting taxes on the wealthiest. That does nothing to build a more kind of thriving economy. You know, the UK, even before this package, had some of the kind of lowest tax rates for corporations within the OECD. And despite that, some of the lowest rates of business investment, some of the most kind of stagnating wages. Mm-hmm. And so all of that, I think, has punched this huge hole in the public budgets that now is leading to, and this is the big fear of the moment, is, you know, austerity round two, this new spending plan for absolutely decimating an already kind of vulnerable public sector.
And Dominic, if you had like a day with a cabinet minister, what would you want to show them, tell them, implore them?
I've got a whole 24 hours.
You've got a whole 24 hours.
I would want them to kind of recognise that poor people have been in a cost of living crisis long before the phrase was popularised, and that it's only now that these price rises are impacting middle and upper classes that is getting this sort of attention. I've got a campaign called Food is Care. One of our objectives is, so my daughter's on free school meals, and there's great work being done by, at the moment, I think it's called Feed the Future, for free school meals to be extended to everyone on universal credit. But as someone whose child is actually on free school meals, they're not free. My daughter often texts me when she's at school saying, "Dad, I haven't got any money left on my farm." So a kid gets £3 a day to spend on food and drink if they're on free school meals. So I wouldn't just say that they need to be extended. I would say that the amount each child is given a day is increased in line with inflation or the rising cost of food, because the amount of food you could get your child for £3 at the beginning of COVID isn't the same amount of food as you can get your kid today. And that also speaks to like the work of Marcus Rashford. It was amazing. We got vouchers, you know, during the recent summer holidays and the Easter or whatever. But that works out at £2.14 a day for your kid when that's stretched over the week. I hope you can imagine that that doesn't feed your child nutritiously. And it also speaks to these, the MP, I think his name was Lee Anderson, saying like, you can feed your family for 30p. Like, I can see on my gas and electric meter just to, you know, to cook chicken, boil rice, pasta, whatever it is. And I like cooking for my amazing daughter, but it costs more than 30p just to do that, let alone the ingredients and the use of the food bank and my cooker from the local homeless charity. And, you know, the windows that don't shut, you're putting your gas and electric on, you know, the blocks in a bit of a mess, and, you know, the bins outside that don't get collected and you can smell in the morning for weeks. So what would I do? I would get the MP. Was it an MP I get?
It was an MP.
Okay, well, I'll take
or,
it.
Or a government minister.
A government minister. I'd take him around my council estate and then...
Cook them one of your amazing meals.
Yeah, to try and persuade
and
them.
And say,
to
this
make
didn't
this.
Cost 30p.
Yeah, this cost £5.15. I'd probably do that.
Well, I really wanted to ask you a bit about that, the way that the government seems to get in the way of you trying to live your life. Because while they've deemed that bankers need uncapped bonuses to incentivise them to work harder, there was part of the mini budget that has gone quite uncovered, which was they're going to force some universal credit claimants to spend 6 hours longer a week actively job seeking or face sanctions. So why is it that there are these cuts built into welfare and also these other punishments, like you were talking about the school vouchers not going up with inflation, that actually get in the way of you living your life and doing your job rather than incentivizing you to work harder?
Yeah.
Is that how it feels?
100%. The challenges you have, just to speak personally, even when I started studying, so living in poverty as a single parent, like you'd feel like you couldn't even vocalize the struggles you were going through in your classroom. And the person next to you might have been going through similar things, but because of that impact that the powers that be view you in a certain undeserving way that it kind of silenced you. So definitely, like, snobbery has silenced the poor for too long. And in terms of like time, I hear my neighbours speaking about, and some of my neighbours are, you know, perhaps older and less mobile than I am, which had a massive impact during COVID, and they could only use the shop in the estate. But they're like spend their day going to different supermarkets that maybe like have a special deal on this, I don't know, on rice or whatever it is, and spend their time on the buses going to different ones for, you know, their tea or their milk or whatever it is. And it doesn't feel like in, I think it's the sixth richest country in the world, that really people should be experiencing that sort of inequality.
No, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because Adrian, I saw you tweeting a piece from the FT that actually described Britain as a poor society, just with some very, rich people living in it. Can you explain a bit about that vision of Britain, because it's not, I think, how we like to see ourselves.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely not. Yeah, when we use statistics like we're the sixth wealthiest economy in the world, I think that we all use those and it completely skirts over how profoundly unequal that distribution is, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it was just a perfect phrasing from John Byrne Murdoch of a poor country broadly with living standards for the vast majority of the population that are below the average for, and I'll use this in scare quotes, the developed world, right? Far below what the average is for most of our kind of peer countries, whereas the top 10% of our society is above average and having a grand old time. And I think it's really important to focus on that distribution rather than the fact that, you know, our GDP is a certain level, because frankly GDP doesn't mean anything until you know how it's distributed, until you know what it's producing, how is that delivering for people's lives, for their well-being, for their health, for planetary health, etc. Just to focus on that figure obscures basically everything that matters.
And one of the trends I've noticed recently is that it's not the usual suspects who've been saying we've got to do something about this. It is now a lot of Tory backbenchers. It's the IMF of all people. Have we reached the point where actually people are waking up to the fact that actually inequality is bad for an economy? That actually the more unequal a society is, the less that society can grow?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, there are some whisperings of that, I guess. You know, the evidence that lower levels of inequality are good for health, for productivity, for everything that sort of mainstream economists say they care about. That's years in the making. It's very clear. And I guess people, you know, because conditions now are so extreme, are maybe beginning to awaken to that. I think it's a tragedy that conditions have to become as extreme as they are for this to be even on the table. But unfortunately, it feels as though the people who currently are pulling all the levers of power are sort of continuing to willfully ignore that case, right? This idea of growing the pie as the objective. It doesn't really matter if you grow the pie if the people at the very top get even more of it. And you end up with less if you're at the bottom. So I think, unfortunately, people in power haven't yet.
Plus, you've got to be able to afford to cook that pie.
Well, exactly.
That's what I tweeted the other day. Liz Truss is so insensitive talking about growing a pie when, you know, the poor don't have the money for the meat and veg or to top up the gas and cook it.
Yeah. We've painted a pretty kind of honest but bleak picture of where we are now. In the remaining time we have, are there any solutions, any suggestions, any positive ways out of this that we can suggest?
I would say that, so I'll just contextualize it. I had a little bit of a very small platform and I was getting asked to write little pieces for social work blogs and stuff, and I was often getting asked to speak about my lived experience of poverty or council estates or my lived experience of food insecurity. And I'll be sitting in my council flat and I'll be writing the blogs and I'll be so grateful that, oh my God, someone wants to see my writing or whatever. But then I started thinking that this isn't my lived experience, this is my living experience. Mm-hmm. And that's a concept that I developed in my first book. Thank you for mentioning. So that brings me to what I would ask the government, or if we had the choice to, is that the government needs a poverty minister or department. They've got all these ministers for this, for that, but poverty has been neglected for so long, and I would suggest that it needs to be someone with living experience of poverty so they can speak to the state mechanisms and they've experienced how the intersecting inequalities from housing to food insecurity to fuel deserts, so that, and that could be like an integral part of forming approaches to policy. And if it's okay to say, with food is care, I want, through my research, the idea of welfare and well-being, which well-being being in the Care Act and welfare and well-being being in the Children's Act 1989, needs to be legally redefined to include food insecurity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so achieving food security for the most disadvantaged would then have a state duty to do that. So that's something I'm really trying to campaign.
And it's pretty amazing that there's no state duty already to make sure that people can eat.
Yeah, there's a sort of state duty to keep debt, a kind of percentage of GDP. There's a duty imposed on the Bank of England to keep inflation within a set. Mm. But yeah, you're right. There isn't, you know, something that's so consequential and has such a kind of pervasive effect on not just the economic health, but our general health.
Yeah.
There isn't actually a system in government that measures it and tries to identify whether we're actually reaching it or not.
And if we look at how we're protected through the Human Rights Act, you know, we're protected from torture, we're protected from all these different things. You're not protected from poverty. And that's something that speaks to that kind of snobbery and idea of people being undeserving.
Yeah.
And have you detected any sort of positive signs in anything government or opposition?
Always the question. There are a lot of kind of policy solutions that are just like floating around, whether that's proposals around a minimum income floor, so complete reform to the kind of benefit system we have to make sure that, you know, at all times people have almost like a thermostat that goes up and down to make sure that you always have enough to live, or whether that's a return of some kind of public ownership in the energy system. The kind of seeds of that are present in what came out of Great British Energy and the Labour Conference, although there's a lot more to that package, I think, that would be needed to really hit energy bills. There are all sorts of ideas floating around that do give me kind of inspiration and hope. What I would say is, you know, it's unlikely that those things will be heard and realized until, you know, we have people like Dominic kind of front and centre, basically speaking about what it's actually like to be on the sharp end of those things. It's very easy, and you know, I work in a think tank, I'm obviously guilty of this. It's very easy to drop big statistics and walk around with like, here's my great policy proposal, and for people to ignore that, right? Because we're completely marginalizing the just harsh reality of everyday life on the sharp end of these very cruel systems. The other thing I would say that gives me actual genuine hope broadly has been the kind of huge resurgence of the trade union movement in the UK over the past few months. And I think one of the biggest kind of strategic points for all of us who care about these issues is to be, you know, unwavering supportive of, you know, rank and file union membership, supportive of strikes, and to hugely resist as much as we can Truss's plans to basically kind of debilitate unions even further, whether that's stricter rules around strike action, etc. You know, that's something that needs to be, I think, strongly resisted, because union action benefits not just those in unions, but absolutely everybody else. It is one of those rare moments where it's a kind of lifts all boats phenomenon.
And I did want to ask you, because you hinted at it, whether or not a Labour government would be the answer. And I think we're allowed to talk about the prospect of a Labour government now, finally, that they're sort of 30 points ahead in some polls. But, you know, they're talking a lot about growth. It was Keir Starmer who first said growth, growth, growth. And he started using the language of the magic money tree, which is, of course, what David Cameron and George Osborne used to accuse Labour of using when they were trying to make cuts to public spending. I mean, is that just a sort of rhetorical stance, or is it worrying that they are taking the conservative framing of the economy? Obviously, if they do get into power, they'll be inheriting some pretty tricky public finances.
Yeah, I do think that the adoption of the framing, not just around how the public finances work, but also a lot of the framings around benefits and around benefit fraud, you know, the fact that that's being adopted by, you know, MPs and Labour Party, hugely problematic. Some of their framing around migrants, around the police crime and sentencing bill. I think there are lots of elements within the current Labour Party that are cause for concern. I do think, however, that there has been sort of a bit of a door opened with what came out of this Labour conference, where, you know, for the first time we really heard some kind of policy vision. And I think things like Great British Energy or the National Wealth Fund, while kind of small on their own, have created a wedge moment where we can really push on some of these issues, which I guess is encouraging. I try to be optimistic.
I don't know, that's what we wanted. And Dominic, I'd love to have your views on the sort of politics of this. You know, do you look to an alternative party in government for help, or is it not how you see your experience?
I heard about like the Labour pushing more towards like public ownership and stuff. And I think that would be something I'd be supportive of. But I was just thinking, it's probably a bit off topic, but around social work and, you know, how social workers are, at the end of the day, they're an arm of of the government, and our professional standards come from the Department for Education, Social Work England, and the British Association of Social Work. And at present, even though those... So just to share a vital statistic of a study by Professor Paul Bywaters, is that you're 10 times more likely, if you're living in a deprived area, to have a social worker involved in the raising of your child than if you live in the more affluent areas of our country. So just with that established, the social work professional standards and guidance, it gives a nod to poverty at present, but it doesn't include food insecurity or fuel poverty, which I would say speaks to like the distance that the people that make this guidance enjoy from the daily realities of poverty. So part of the work that I'm doing, and something I would suggest that the government could get behind, who knows, is that food insecurity and the realities of that, and as we've spoken about, the impacts of that needs to be discussed and included in the professional standards for social workers. Because just to re-highlight that, you know, social workers are tasked with dealing with some of the most vulnerable people in our society.
Important so again, approach. It's the point of the distance between those who are trying to run things and trying to change things with the actual reality that someone like you has been shining a light on in this discussion.
Okay. And the barriers I've met have been like, there is a level of like dismissing a voice from poverty that I've experienced in that goes against, you know, professional values and ethics.
It's on the one hand, they say, you know, everyone should have a right to this, everyone should have an opportunity, access to educational opportunities, and so on. On the other hand, people being stigmatized by their background, and which goes against the kind of the whole ethos of we're all in this together.
Which is why I'm so glad that we had you on.
Thank you so much, both of you.
Well, that was really interesting, especially what Dominic was saying about there not being enough people making the decisions who understand.
Absolutely.
Like
we have an equalities minister. We have a minister for the North. You know, we have all these genre ministers. And yet, you know, the biggest thing of the lot, income inequality. Mm. We even have a levelling up minister who you think would be. But I think that post has now gone
unfilled. It means different things to different government.
It's a huge thing. You know, it struck me that we do these podcasts in the New Statesman's offices in Hatton Garden. We're surrounded by...
By diamonds. Literally, yeah.
And what Dominic was saying about how our resources are all out there, and yet for some reason we're not distributing them fairly enough. Adrian was saying all the statistics and plans and things are out there showing that wealth inequality actually is bad for the economy. And I did think, have we stressed that enough? You know, are people aware of that? Should we be doing more to kind of outline what effect it has on the economy and why actually it makes good economic sense to reduce wealth inequality? Maybe we're just assuming that people know this and that it's blindingly obvious, but maybe actually we haven't done enough to articulate that.
Well, yes, clearly the sort of moral failings of the situation aren't enough to get through to the government that we have at the moment. So maybe that argument about how it actually holds back growth would be more productive.
Exactly.
And actually, you know, what Adrian was saying about us basically being a poor society with a few rich people living in it, that's bad for growth. Because if you say, if you put universal credit up, which this government is very reluctant to do, then those people will spend their money. Whereas if you give more money to the rich, then they save it or they put it in assets and it doesn't trickle down as is supposed to be the way. Yes. And actually, Adrian mentioned that we don't compare well to some so-called developing countries. I was looking this up, and the average UK household is actually 20% worse off than its equivalent in northwestern Europe. But even in eastern Europe, some countries are pulling away from us. So the average Slovenian household will be better off than its British counterpart by 2024. No offence to Slovenia, but that's not something that I think sort of British politicians would necessarily want to be the case. But that's where we're heading. Thanks so much, Armando.
Thanks. And Anoush, what are we discussing next?
We're going to be talking about US politics and if the UK is just following its lead with John Stewart and broadcaster Sam Walker. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to Westminster Reimagined on the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and our special guest host, Armando Iannucci. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review and don't forget to subscribe.
You can watch video from this podcast on the New Statesman's YouTube channel and on the New Statesman website. This episode was produced by Adrian Bradley and May Robson. Our executive producer is Chris Stone.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello? Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.